Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The feminist scholar Gloria Anzaldúa wrote, "The U.S.-Mexican border es una herida abierta, an open wound, where the Third World grates against the First and bleeds." It wasn't long ago when border residents regularly crossed back and forth without passports or papers, without customs agents giving us a second look. The border was where you took visitors to eat, drink, and shop. But then that herida, that scab, that wound began to hemorrhage, and it hasn't stopped bleeding. Cartel violence, disappeared women, mass graves, armed Mexican soldiers on one side, border patrol on the other. Norma Elia Cantú is a self-described daughter of the borderlands, born on the Laredo-Nuevo Laredo border. She's a folklorist, writer, and Murchison Professor of Humanities at San Antonio's Trinity University. Cantú's new collection of poetry is Meditación Fronteriza, Poems of Love, Life, and Labor. The poems explore the joy, the sadness, the love, the life, and the deaths experienced along the border. Cantú says the changes she's seen at the border are a combination of various factors, including cartels, the terrorist attacks of September 11th, and even NAFTA.
All of these change points have, I think, a historical significance, an economic significance, a personal significance for those of us who live on the border. I lived in Laredo all my life until 2000 when I moved to San Antonio. And it was really different. It was a different world. Not just because the crossing was so easy, but the cultural facility of going from one to the next. We would have writers' conferences in one, and everybody would come from both sides. Now that's difficult. It's different because it's difficult to do that. And it's difficult because of the constraints, and also, I think, the ethos of what it is to be on the border on the Mexican side has changed. It is about fear. People are afraid. And when you have fear, it changes everything. There's, of course, lack of freedom. You don't have the freedom to just go out at 10 at night and to go for a stroll at the plaza because you can't. It's not safe. You can't just have the freedom of going from Laredo, driving to Monterrey with your family because it's not safe. And I know a lot of people still do it, including some members of my family. So it doesn't affect everyone the same way, but some people haven't crossed, I would say, in decades because of that fear. And to me, that's very sad. It changes the fabric of the society. It changes our relationship with each other on both sides of that border. It's just sad. The poems kind of reflect some of that. In Meditación Fronteriza, the title poem, I put it out there. It's more blatant. But it's inherent in some of the other poems. There's poems about death, people who drown on the river. But there's also some poems about the indigenous people that were there before we got here, before the Spanish got here. And what that means, that we are still here. We may not have a tribe. We're detribalized. We may not have the traditions exactly the way they did, but they're still there. It's still part of who we are.
And there's also some personal poems that are in here as well, directed towards other people, a poem for an algebra teacher, a poem for Audrey Rich, a poem for Sor Juana. Can you explain why you wanted to include those?
It started a long time ago that I started writing these occasional poems, usually when somebody died. Like when Gwendolyn Brooks passed, I was struck. I started crying. And so one way that I usually deal with pain is I write poems. And so I wrote a poem for her. And I had been teaching her that semester, and so it was just very present. So there are other poets that I write about, like Adrienne Rich, who was an incredible influence in my own work way early. As a lesbian feminist, she just opened up all kinds of ideas and doors and things. So, yeah, those poems that are directed at individuals, usually there's a reason. There's a corrido, the only corrido in the book, for Laura Rendon, a good friend of mine, for her birthday. And so, yeah, there's some that are, they're not really character profiles, but you get a good sense of who that person is from reading the poem.
There's one in there that also requires a cast of characters.
Yes, a dramatic poem where I was playing with my students about the history and the indigenous. Actually, I wrote it, but for them, they had to act it out. And I give the voices, the male voices and the female voices, roles to recite the poem. And it's just beautiful when people, when I actually get the class to read it like that, it's like a concert. Because the voices are coming in and out. And it is about being from South Texas, from the border.
And again, it sort of points out the fact that poetry is a performance art. It's not just you sit and you read.
Exactly.
It's to be heard as well.
Yes, yes. And I am finding that out as I'm going around doing readings. There's a poem about my mother's hands, it's called. And every time I read it, people just respond. And I think it's if they read it on the page, it doesn't have the same impact as when I read it aloud or when they read it aloud.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to ask you to read it aloud now.
Of course. And it is one of my favorite poems in the book. It was added pretty late. It was not one of the early ones because it's when my mother, suffering from Alzheimer's, is just old. And I kind of don't know exactly what to do with that. She had Alzheimer's. She would recognize us and then she wouldn't. There were things going on in our lives, in our family. And the poem just kind of came. It's a prose poem. And it's going to be part of another book I'm working on. I don't know when that'll be finished, called She Loved the Sea. My mother was from Corpus and she loved the sea. And so it's about her relationship with the ocean, with the Gulf Coast, with water. And also with my father and her sibling, her only sister, Miti Eloisa. It starts in 1925 when she's born in Corpus, and it goes kind of through her life. And they're all kind of this kind of poem. This is one of the ones that's at the very end. My mother's hands. Those hands, her hands, I know them well. My mother's hands, hands that wipe many a baby's bottom. Hands that crocheted booties, hats, blouses, scarves, tablecloths, and afghans. Those hands that rolled out thousands of flour tortillas, empanadas, pie crusts, tortillas y azúcar. Hands that lovingly caressed my father's face, that wiped a child's feverish forehead, that playfully patted a passing child's behind, maybe even raise the chancla to threaten a child acting all chiflado. Hands that massaged a colicky baby with olive oil. Hands that smacked a mosquito about to bite her baby. And equally adept, shoot away a fly from landing on her face. Hands espulgando a grandchild en las tardes de verano, piojito. Or espulgando a beloved pet, looking for pulgas or garrapatas. These are my mother's hands. In youth, deftly applying lipstick. Now, gently but obsessively, nervously twitching. Wrinkled and worn out, yet warm and loving. She holds out her hands. Mira que vieja estoy, she exclaims, surprised by the wrinkled skin, the liver spots, the twitch. At every goodbye, she expertly forms the cross with her thumb and index finger, touches my forehead, and blesses me. Que Diosito te bendiga.
Well, what's next for Norma Cantú? You were saying earlier you were writing a book called Shampoo?
Or Hair Matters.
Okay.
And that's the next novel or fiction. That has a lot more fiction. It's not just about me, although I'm in there. But it also celebrates characters in my community, people who I grew up with, that I love, and personajes, you know, just characters. The DJ, Luciano Guajardo, who was there playing the songs on the radio at KVOSD in Laredo all my childhood and youth, who would have dedicatorias. He's in it. Altagracia Cios, who was a dance teacher of folklorico and ballet and flamenco. She's in there. Lots of hair people. It's champú.
I understand you had a little bit of a background doing
hairstyling. I was trained. I studied in Monterrey, not very long, just a summer, but enough to win a couple of prizes for my hair designs. And to kind of love that world of taking care of the body, of making oneself beautiful and others. And also in champú, there's a beauty shop where a lot of the action happens. Almost all of it is told in the beauty shop. But in the back, there's a little cuartito, a little room, where Doña Lala reads cards, tarot cards. Actually, she doesn't read tarot. It's like tarot, but it's a Spanish deck that they use in Laredo to read cards. So it's kind of taking care of the spiritual as well as the physical.
I understand you're also co-editing a book about Mexican fashion. Is that correct?
Kind of. It's called Mexicana Fashions, and it is about the performance of identity through clothing. And so, yeah, Aida Hurtado, my colleague, and I co-edited. It's out in January. I'm also editing another one right now with a couple of former students that works with Ansaldúa and the teaching of Gloria Ansaldúa. And that we're just in the middle of it right now, trying to finish up.
Norma Elia Cantú is a folklorist, writer, and Murchison Professor of Humanities at San Antonio's Trinity University. Her first collection of poetry is Meditación Fronteriza, Poems of Love, Life, and Labor. When we come back,
making the tamales after so many years and all my experiences, I problem solved making 150 pounds of masa.
We get the secret from a couple of comadres next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The Mexican culture comes alive every holiday season with tamales. Making tamales is a family affair where everyone has a role. In 2017, I had a chance to talk with a couple of tamaleras, Carmen Tafoya and Ellen Riojas Clark. Tafoya is the former poet laureate for San Antonio and the state of Texas. Clark is professor emerita in the Division of Bicultural Bilingual Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio. They're both the co-authors of Tamales, Comadres, and the Meaning of Civilization. Tafoya says tamales date back centuries and are central to our culture.
Well, tamales are so much a part of our heritage. They go back at least 7,000 years on the American continents. They carry a lot of significance to our people. And the reason we entitled it Tamales Comadres and the Meaning of Civilization was because civilization implies a collaboration. It's a complex collaboration between individuals, which is what happens in a tamalada. So we envisioned what happened in that first cave kitchen 7,000 years ago when two comadres are sitting in the kitchen, or maybe three or five or ten, and they invent what becomes the first fast food wrapped in a disposable shuck. All of the indigenous peoples of the Americas talk about corn as an essential part of their civilization. In the sacred book of the Mayas, the Popol Vuh, human beings are made out of cornmeal. And so they try to create human beings, and they create them out of mud, and the mud just slips apart, and it doesn't have any strength or shape or sustenance to it. They try creating them out of wood, so it'll be firm and strong, and they're stiff. They don't smile. They don't move. And then they look at the corn stalk, and they think about cornmeal, and they shape a human being out of corn. So it becomes a beautiful tradition to call ourselves the children of corn.
And then the issue of comadres is the natural outcome of that, co-mother. So it's a formal title and an informal title. So it can be a formal title if you're the godparent of someone, and then you become the co-mother with the parents. Or you just become like Carmen and I, or co-mothers, just because we're very, very good friends and do a lot of things together. So it's a term of endearment, and it is a formal term. And as she spoke, you have to have collaboration. So you do bring all your comadres and your friends together to do a tamalada. So why do we in South Texas, and actually all the United States now, is that we use tamales as a celebratory event, because they were originally used as food for the gods. So they were used to commemorate religious ceremonies and any type of formal celebration. So that's why we do them at Christmas.
So what's the minimum amount of people required for a tamalada?
That's a very good question. If you're doing 15 pounds of masa, that's going to give you 15 dozen tamales, you would need at least two, at the minimum, two people. Believe it or not, I used to do 150 pounds of masa. Wow is right.
So can you break down sort of the anatomy of a tamal? Because
sure.
We know there are people here who are recent to San Antonio who may not be familiar with why we're crazy about tamales in South Texas. So if you could possibly, you know, break it down.
Well, that comes out in our book, because one of the things we tried to do with the book was to fill it with all the variety of information that people share at a tamalada. So there were secrets, there were stories, there was chisme, which means gossip. There was history, there was heritage, there was laughter. And when you look at all the variations of tamales, you find that you might fill them with chicken, you might fill them with beans. It might be green corn tamales, which include the actual kernels in there. There might be sweet tamales. There are vegetarian tamales. There are shrimp tamales. You can find tamales of all variety and all sizes. In Mexico, there are certain villages that still use the tamalón, which is a 3-foot-long tamal, very large, big enough to fit entire chickens in the center, and the entire neighborhood sits down to eat from that one tamal. They open the shuck up, and everybody digs in and serves themselves from this giant tamal. So all of these variations are all tamales, but they're tamales that reflect the idiosyncrasies of that family and the memories of that family and the memories of the making of tamales, which begin with many people when they're children and they watch their grandmothers or their great-grandmothers, their aunts and fathers and cousins all together collaborating.
Making the tamales after so many years and all my experiences, I problem solved making 150 pounds of masa. So I would use my top loading washing machine, and you listeners have to make sure it's top loading, and you would rinse it out with lots of vinegar so that all the soap residue gets out. You fill it up with the hottest water, and then you put the dried corn shucks that Carmen was talking about in there to soften overnight. Do not agitate. All you do then is pull out the little stopper and let it spin, fill it up again. So that's how I was able to do that many hojas. And then for the masa, you have to beat it with your arms. And it's really
it's a good workout.
A task. It's a big workout. And I did not want to look like Marilyn Monroe, so I figured I could use my huge beaters to do it. So I would do 150. But then you do the presentation of putting all that masa you did with your mixer, you put it in a big, big clay pot and do the presentation in a beautiful way. So when everybody comes in, you do put your hands in and start beating.
So a final question. What are your favorite tamales? I'll go with you, Ellen.
Okay, my favorite one are chicken with rajas de chile poblano, which is a big green fresh chili with some jalapeno and some cilantro and tomatillos. The masa is white as opposed to red. Those are my favorite. And then along with that, I'm not a bean person, but all of a sudden I've discovered the bean tamal with pickled jalapenos and a little bit of chicharrones in it. And it's very, very good.
Carmen?
It's hard to pick, but I like what I call chaos theory tamales. I had two aunts that lived far out in the country. This was a long time ago before tamales were easily accessible. You had to make them if you wanted them, and they were overcome with a hunger for tamales one afternoon. They said, it's ridiculous. There's no way we can have tamales ready between now and supper. And since they were out in the country on a rancho, they grabbed some green shucks off the stalks, fresh, and they cut the corn and the meat and all the ingredients that they would usually put carefully assembled into a tamal, threw it into a frying pan, cooked it all up very rapidly in an emergency manner, and put it inside the green shuck, which gave it a whole different flavor. And they liked it so much, and the family liked it so much, that they kept making it for generations until they were old ladies. And would you believe that I can still taste those tamales in my mouth exactly the way they made them years ago?
That's my 2017 conversation with Carmen Tafoya and Ellen Riojas Clark. They're co-authors of Tamales, Comadres, and the Meaning of Civilization. Tafoya is a former San Antonio and State Poet Laureate, professor emeritus at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and president of the Texas Institute of Letters. Clark is professor emerita in the Division of Bicultural Bilingual Studies at UTSA. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Brie Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. And our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Happy holidays and Feliz Navidad.